Blog Talk Radio.
You got to listen to the Bob Carson Show. It's about the real deal. And this is Les Leopold, the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter, an attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on. Not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Greg Palin, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio. Radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Hello, everyone around the world. Once again, this is Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. I am one of your hosts, Mr. Bob Carson, Christopher Allen Driscoll, former media director for Ralph Nader and fellow Election Boycott Advocate member, is not able to make it here tonight. He is flying back currently to Arizona. We will resume our regular time next week with our regular band of hosts, myself and him. And so we wish Christopher all the best, safe travels. It's not going to be easy without him, for sure. Christopher has just been the driving force behind this show and behind the election boycott advocates. So it's been a while since I did one of these political shows by myself, and I'm going to try to go for as long as I can. I have a YouTube stream going, but it's not working correctly. I'll be honest with you. I'm a little bit shaky with the YouTube, the live streaming. I'm not as comfortable as I am with Blog Talk Radio, because with Blog Talk Radio, I've been on this network for 5 years now, going on 6 years. So I know how to work Blog Talk Radio. But when it comes to actual streaming, live streaming, I mean, I can do Facebook live streaming, but YouTube is a whole different animal. But ideally, I would like to stream on YouTube, because YouTube, anybody can watch you, whereas Facebook, you know, it's open to the public, but mainly your friends just watch you on Facebook. So, you know, I want to get that down, Pat. It's I'm using this program called OSB, and I haven't figured out how to link it yet with Facebook. I for some reason, the webcam is not appearing, which is very, very disappointing. But it is what it is here. Hopefully, at least people on YouTube can at least hear me. I'm hoping to at least give you that, you know, at least some sort of audio show here. And you can chime in on the chat room. We also have the chat room open here on Blog Talk Radio. If you have a question, comment, or concern, make sure to chime in our chat room, or give me a call at 347-326-9749. That is 347-326-9749. We have a lot to talk about today. A lot of passions. Passions are running high now for all the wrong reasons, I think, but I'm going to get into that in just a little while. And also, too, if you want to visit our website, you can, electionboycott.weebly.com. That is electionboycott.weebly.com. I'm going to go over some of our tenets, some of our positions on how we transition from the misery known as capitalism to a better society, a new world, as Harry Kaysen from the Zeitgeist Movement would say. That's all coming up. And if you want to friend me on Facebook individually, you can at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. That's facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Also, I'm on Twitter, the same Twitter, same handle, BobCarsonMMA. All right, so we have a media-induced, media-driven, I think, controversy here, with the national football players refusing to stand during the national anthem, kneeling during the national anthem. And recently, Donald Trump, our president, came out and, you know, insulted the players, says that they should stand up during the national anthem, you know, saying something to the effect that they can leave this country. The old love it or leave it sort of technique, I think, designed to keep us locked into the status quo. Now, look, I don't have a television, okay? I haven't owned a television since 2008, and I'm very, very proud of that. It's been almost 10 years since I owned a television. I can't afford it. The cable bill now is like a car bill. It used to be, you know, you can get cable for $70, $80, get all the movie channels. Now, you know, it's like $300-$400. It's absurd. I don't like watching television anyway. It's all filled with propaganda, constant bombarding people of images of what they should look like and what they should act like. There's interesting program here and there on television, but by and large, it's all propaganda. It's all corporate-driven propaganda. Remember, we know that six corporations own all of the media. Six corporations control what you see, what you hear, and what you read. And that's absolutely true. And if you think that doesn't influence products, if you think that, you know, that doesn't have an effect on people, you're absolutely crazy. You really are, because there was a time in this country where we had, you know, hundreds of television stations and media companies, you know, before the Clinton administration, you know, Clinton, the 1996 Communications Act, which Bill Clinton was in favor for, essentially created a monopoly in the media world, and that's what we have right now. So I don't watch this stuff. I'll be honest with you. I don't care about professional sports because I believe that professional sports, by and large, are opium for the masses. And look, I like my MMA. Don't get me wrong. I cover mixed martial arts, but it's not important at the end of the day. It's more along the lines of entertainment for me. So I don't watch this stuff. And, you know, NFL players, what they do and what they don't do, to me, makes no difference whatsoever. I mean, these people are in the top 1%. I mean, if you're an athlete and you're lucky enough to have the athletic ability to where you could go and play in the NFL, and think about most college players, most people that get to the college level don't even go on to the NFL. Something like only 1% of college players actually go to the NFL. And then when they get to the NFL, presumably they're making a lot of money, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. I don't know what the average NFL player makes, but it's a lot more money than you and I make, believe me. And, you know, so therefore, there's no connection, really, I would argue, there's no connection between NFL players and the working class. I mean, that's just the way it is. Even though, you know, some of these guys, I'm sure, came from poor and impoverished areas. I mean, sports being one of the only professions in America where you can actually be poor and get to the top, become a millionaire if you're a sports player, if you're a rapper, because it's pretty objective. It's there's not a lot of politics involved. There's not a lot of, you know, generational opportunities, as is the case with a lot of other professions in capitalist America. I mean, if you're a great athlete, if you're a great player, that's it. That's your ticket to a better life where your needs are addressed and taken care of. So I don't really care for it. I don't care for NFL players, and I don't care for the sport of NFL, of football. I really don't, and I haven't for, you know, probably 20-plus years, or whatever it is. But, you know, you've got this started with Colin Kaepernick. Was it last year or the year before where Colin Kaepernick, who played for, was it the 49ers, kneeled down during the national anthem because he was protesting police brutality. He was protesting the high-profile cases in which African-Americans have been shot by the police, often without any accountability. And he was doing this, and he was criticized for you know, not standing up. This was just the subject of all sorts of scrutiny. And it's spread on now to other players are starting to do it now, and teams are starting to do it now. It's almost like becoming fashionable. And now you have NFL owners. You have Jerry Jones, I believe, the owner of the Cowboys or whatever, do it last Sunday. And so it's becoming hip to do it now. It's becoming like I said, fashionable for these guys to do it. And then you have Donald Trump that came out and said, you know, what I said earlier. And this just makes the situation worse, because Donald Trump, if you recall, during the Charlottesville riots, Donald Trump reciprocally, if that's a word, defended the white supremacists out there. I mean, this guy, he had a press conference. I remember I was in Las Vegas at the time, where he was defending these white supremacists, saying there's good people on both sides, saying that you know, there are some good people mixed in with the white supremacists, and they have a right to you know, and it was the other side that was violent, basically giving these white supremacists, these white nationalists, a cover. You know, being an ally for them, sympathizing with them and whatnot. And so, you know, he just seemed to really have a soft spot, as we know he does, for white supremacists out there and whatnot. And then now when it comes to the NFL players, right, they have to stand up for the national anthem. They have to stand up for the flag. There's no you know, room for dissent there. There's no room for any other type of opinion. It's our way or the highway. And it's a double standard. That's what bothers me about this whole thing. It's a double standard. It really is. If you're going to say that white supremacists have a right to free speech, they could say whatever they want. They could march. They could demonstrate. You know, they could have their tiki torches. They could do whatever the hell they want. Why is it that black football players can't do the same? Why can't we have that? You know, why is that somehow off limits or you know, they're not patriotic or fill in the blank? And Donald Trump, unfortunately, politically knows that, you know, he's got 30-35% of his base that like him because you know, he speaks out against the, quote, you know, PC culture, and speaks out against, you know, minorities, and speaks out against how dangerous immigrants are. The same, you know, right-wing crap that we hear and we see in the media with Fox News and right-wing talk radio that infects millions and millions of Americans. Take my word for it. Millions and millions of Americans are infected by this right wing, you know, blame immigrants, you know, blame minorities, black laziness, the culture of inferiority, blame all this stuff for a failing economic system and pit one worker versus the other. And it works like a charm. I mean, it's been working in this country, you know, for quite some time now. It's just absolutely ridiculous. People can protest any way they want to, as long as it's legal. On my car, I have a Black Lives Matter bumper sticker, okay? And I find that the people that are outraged by my sticker, they don't want to have a discussion. They don't want to have any type of discussion because they get worked up and start cursing at me and start saying this to, like, my family. It's why I can't be around my family members, because they're not capable of having a political dialogue. They're too consumed with anger and hatred, and any other viewpoint is just absolutely ridiculous. It's un-American. It's unpatriotic. Whatever this is, bumper sticker patriotism. Now, I can intellectually defend my support for the Black Lives Matter movement. I feel against anybody. I'm proud to have that bumper sticker, and I'm proud to engage in the political process how I feel fit. The NFL players are no different. You know, I don't think it's constructive, to be honest with you. I don't think that anything has changed. I mean, since Colin Kaepernick started doing this and since some of the other players started kneeling, have things changed in America? Have there been less police shootings? Has there been less police brutality? Is the 1% getting less greedy? You know, are the wealthy not skirting laws any you know, less now than they were, you know, prior to Colin Kaepernick's protests? No, absolutely not. But it's their right to do it, and it's unfortunately fodder for a corporate media. And as I understand it, and like I said, I don't follow football at all. But it has had an impact on the ratings of the NFL. And I don't think that's a bad thing. You know why? Because the NFL owners are mainly white, you know, right-wing individuals that, you know, have the same, by and large, mindset as many members of the business community do. You know, Colin Kaepernick, in a way, it's admirable what he did, because Colin Kaepernick now has no career. No team will hire him, which is a travesty considering looking at all the other NFL players that have had criminal records for just horrific things like rape and spousal abuse and you know, being a homicide, you know, just all, fill in the blank. And yet, politically, it's more acceptable in that community, in the white, you know, NFL owners community, it's more politically feasible to hire, you know, some of these players that have the criminal records as opposed to somebody like Colin Kaepernick. So what I hope happens is I hope that Kaepernick actually gets some sort of job as a host on RT or one of these other networks, and he starts contributing that way, because that's the best way to do it, in my opinion, one of the best ways to do it. You know, join a political group or join a political movement or start podcasting or start blogging, pitch in where you fit in. That's a very, very important way to sort of reverse the trend. What we're not seeing with these NFL players is we're not seeing a move towards socialism. That would be absolutely ideal. Instead of, you know, merely reacting to, you know, police brutality and whatever injustices are going on in the system, if they would react by, you know, moving towards socialism, promoting socialism, speaking out against the inherent problems with capitalism, speaking out against America as it stands right now is basically, you know, an oligarchy. That's a very, very important point to arrive at, and that, in my opinion, would be more constructive than just, you know, merely just being reactionary. And again, you know, this is what we see right now. You know, the ruling class is comfortable with this type of dissent because, you know, it can be discussed and it could be used to shield the issues that really affect the working class. And so they're comfortable with these players kneeling. They're comfortable having the you know, talk show debates where you got one side and another side. And at the end of the day, like I said before, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed in this system whatsoever, despite, you know, the NFL player protests. It means nothing. Business is as usual in America, and that is the problem. Business is the problem. The economic system is the problem, because as we've spoken about before on this program, police brutality, all of the different strands of oppression, all trace back to the underlying priorities of the economic system of capitalism. And until you start to address the economic system of capitalism, then nothing is going to change. No amount of income inequality is going to change. No amount of police brutality, no amount of black incarceration, oppression, it's not going to change. So we can expect the same results. And, you know, like I was saying earlier, if Donald Trump were a different president, you know, usually presidents try to appear nonpartisan. Usually they'll you know, try to appear to take both sides of an issue, but that's not the case with Donald Trump, and that's going to be a problem as we go forward, because, again, Donald Trump is representing the Fox News crowd. The rabid, you know, anti-immigrant crowd, the rabid anti anything that challenges their point of view, you know, the Fox News, the New York Post crowd, fill in the blank. That's who he's representing. You know, 20 however many Americans it is, but he's got about 25% of Americans, 30% of Americans that won't leave him at all. And it's like Steve Bannon said, his former advisor said, you know, never leave your base. And so that's what we could really, really expect for the duration of his first presidential term. So that's causing some of this, you know, the reaction. But politically, it's not good. It's not bad for him. It really, really is not, you know. So we'll see what happens. I mean, again, I'm not really interested in this stuff, but people love talking about it, and this ignites such a debate. You know, people are just so passionate about this, and you know, what bothers me is just the double standard. That's all. The hypocrisy out there of people that are generally Trump supporters and, you know, Fox News consumers and consumers of talk radio, and it's just a mortal sin if you don't stand up for the national anthem or you don't salute the flag or you're disrespecting the soldiers or you're disrespecting this and that. And again, it's that intolerance that I can't stand, because these same people a lot of times talk about, you know, a white supremacist right to speak, and a white supremacist, you know, should be able to have a bullhorn and not be shut down and whatnot. And they have no tolerance for anything other than material that reinforces their political points of view. Again, my family is the same thing. That's why I can't be around my siblings, because it's a real double standard. You know, they constantly curse at me and talk about, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And if I say a word back to them, like, because they can't have a debate, they can't have a discussion. If I say a word back to them that refutes anything that they believe, that they've been told to believe by whatever right-wing source they're listening to, they get, like, hostile, and it just becomes this aggressive environment. And I don't have tolerance for that. I don't want to be involved with – I don't want to be in a situation like that. And that's how these people are. So that's why I've learned that you can't really talk to these people. It does me no good to be around people like this in my life. It just doesn't do a scintilla of good. I don't care if they're family members. It just raises my blood pressure, just causes me more aggravation. And I'm telling you that white America, the Trump supporters out there, they're angry. They're angry at the changing demographics. They're angry that, you know, they're losing their majority. And they feel that minorities out there, which will become the majority by 2049, by 2050, will oppress them the way that they've oppressed minorities, you know, going back to the 1800s. That's what they are. And, you know, they're feeling the economic pressure just as we are. They feel that the American dream no longer exists. It's merely anecdotal. They feel that the expectations that they have for themselves and for their kids are diverging from the reality, which is true. You know, people no longer have that anymore. You no longer can expect to have a house and, you know, a yard and college education. Now you're lucky if you're out of debt. I mean, that's the reality brought to us by capitalism. And, you know, they on some point they realize that, you know, all of this is just very, very precarious. I mean, we're hanging on by a thread, weeks from the street under capitalism. But they don't know how to direct their anger at the right people or the system itself. They instead direct them at those highly visible members of society, which are immigrants, you know, minorities, the people that they've been led to hate. And they do hate them, make no mistake about it. Still, it's a very old scapegoat. All right, I'm going to take a brief time out here on Carson's Corner. And when we come back, I want to visit the election boycott website. The Election Boycott Advocates, we have a website, electionboycott.weebly.com. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the tenets on that website. Very, very important stuff. It never hurts to reiterate our goals and talk about our manifesto. So keep it right here on Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Carson's Corner. Mine is Christopher Alan Driscoll. It is your host, Bob Carson. And we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes, folks.
Christopher Malley went out on a bridge down in Chehalis, clutching his Bible and a letter from her fell into the river. Pity no one was there, no angels in the air, and the paper ran. One more suicide. Yeah. His mama stayed by the riverside down in Chehalis, clutching her Bible and a letter from him fell in to crying. No angels in the air, and the morning paper ran. One more suicide. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're back here on Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson, and you are listening to Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. We've been around since arguably 2012, and it's really kind of hard to trace the origins of this group. It all started, I think, with Marky Smith's book, Consent to Tyranny. And Terry Lee kind of hooked up with Mark, and they brought him over to this show. And that's when we became Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. We started back in 2013. We had meetings. The meetings really didn't kind of work out too well. And so we've spread to a Facebook group and a podcast. And we have our podcast every Monday, and the Facebook is available 365 days a year, 24/7. It's got over 600 members, and we have a website, electionboycott.weebly.com. The name is self-explanatory, but I got to tell you, if you go to the Election Boycott website and you click our manifesto, there's so much on that site. Most of it was written, I believe, by Christopher Alan Driscoll, but it's brilliant stuff because it says what needs to be done. And I'm going to read some from the manifesto, and I want to, kind of comment on it too, because this is stuff that we've been talking about for 4 years now on Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. All right. every show or so, you know, we talk about it, but it's just very, very important. And again, it bears repeating. We need this to be repeated. Now, what are we talking about in terms of a post-capitalist society? You know, what would the election boycott advocates do if a number of Americans, if the silent majority, which don't vote, and I'm going to talk about that in just a few moments, delegitimize the government, our plutocratic government, and the workers take control. The workers control our institutions. They overthrow the capitalist class, the ruling class, and we have democracy. You know, because we don't have democracy now. I mean, give me a break. You go to your employer. Your employer can do whatever the hell you want. They want with you. Private businesses under capitalism are essentially totalitarian institutions. Workers have no rights. I mean, literally, right? I mean, this is not hyperbole. This is the absolute truth. A worker has no rights. Your employer can force you to do 5 different jobs, can fire you, can move you, can, you know, force you to work nights, force you to do whatever the hell they want to so that they can make more money off of you, so that they can further exploit you. You could be working for a business for 30 years and not have a legal right, not have any standing. That's not democracy. Okay, workers have no say in the decisions. And so, you know, we're not a democracy. The wealthy own the government. The ruling elite get past the laws that they want to get passed to basically get more money in their pockets, more power, whatnot. The countervailing institutions to corporate power have been evaporated. All right? So the first thing, one of the things that the workers, the election boycott advocates would do is create large numbers of worker-owned and managed commercial enterprises to replace the totalitarian privately owned enterprises. All right, let's just take that one step at a time here. Now, again, you know, no unionization right now in our workplace. The private sector unionization rate is a joke. Public sector unions are on their way out. I predict that it'll be very, very soon now, if you look at the makeup of the Supreme Court, that, you know, public sector unions, because everybody wants to become a public sector worker. Everybody wants to work for the post office. They want a pension. They want job security, but that can't exist under capitalism, because the workers have to give more and more and more of their paycheck to the ruling class so that the ruling class can continue to make more and more and more profits to keep up with the declining rate of profit through inflation. And so that's what happens. You know, we're going further and further and further into the abyss so that they can, again, remain competitive in this warped, dysfunctional capitalist system, right? And what this does here, this tenet, my interpretation is it redefines ownership in capitalism. And this is a very, very important point, because Christopher Alan Driscoll always talks about productive property in America, okay? Productive property. What is productive property as opposed to private property? Can productive property be arranged the way it is right now under capitalism, where basically you have one owner, or, you know, it could be a partnership, different business owners, ownership types, but really, you know, you have a small group of people that own productive property that's on public land that is protected by, you know, public police departments, a public court system, you know, public roadways. The commons are used, and the businessman, the plutocratic businessman, uses this productive property to make a profit while screwing his workers, you know, however they see fit, by not paying the workers the surplus value, by all sorts of things. So post-revolution, when the workers take control, they say, no longer can we have the productive property arranged the way it's arranged now under capitalism. It's fundamentally undemocratic. Do the workers have a say in what happens? Do the workers share the profits of the business equally? No, absolutely not. Not under this system. But the workers would own and manage the commercial enterprises, which is productive property. The workers would have a stake in their businesses, whereas now they have no stake whatsoever. The workers have a certain percentage of ownership in that company. And at the end of the day, whatever money that company makes, that gets evenly distributed. Think about how much better of a society would be. I mean, think about, you know, how much less problems we'd have. Think about, you know, all the social ills that go along with capitalism that would be eliminated if you had worker-owned cooperatives and you redefined ownership under capitalism. No longer can we have, you know, businesses own the way they're owned right now. Businesses are a part of the community and vice versa. And if your business is on public land, if it's productive property, then you have to abide by certain tenets here, not by your own personal greed. And if you don't, then you don't belong in our society. You know, you're a mini dictator as far as I'm concerned. And you could spare me these stupid terms, these euphemisms that we use to describe, you know, dictators, exploiters. We call them entrepreneurs, businessmen. They're exploiters. They all have that same mindset. Oh, I'm in business to make money. You know, I took so much risk to start this business. It's the same line. It's the same crap. They're all the same. And if they don't want to work under these conditions and they're undemocratic and they should be marginalized, you know, I'm talking about marginalization through schools of thought. And, you know, they need to be relegated to the fringe. They can't operate in this post-capitalist, you know, world. The next part of the sentence goes, as well as established publicly run banks and utilities, including a thorough democratization of the Federal Reserve Bank. That is huge. Publicly run banks. I mean, if you said that now, if you had a politician that ran on the platform of publicly run banks, I mean, they would be... God knows what would happen to them, you know? I mean, seriously, if you had a politician that seriously believed that and seriously ran on, you know, basically having the Federal Reserve banks be publicly run, you know, that person, you know, wouldn't last, because everything's privately run. You know, profits are privatized and losses are socialized. Everybody is a socialist when it's convenient for them. And so if you had publicly run banks, the decisions would be made by the banks of that, the workers of that community. And the workers of that community know the community needs better than some shareholder board in another state across country. They would know, you know, how much money is to be made. The decisions on where to put money and interest rates and fill in the blank would be made publicly, would be made democratically, you know, like credit unions and whatnot. And so we wouldn't have banks, you know, owning businesses and putting a stranglehold on businesses with high interest rates and you know, these predatory loan contracts that we've seen over the last 10 years. We wouldn't have the volatility that we have right now under capitalism, you know, where a few banks own the money, Federal Reserve, you know, prints the money, loans the money to the government, and they set the interest rate, and they control the money supply. And so if they control the money supply, then they control everything. They control the economy. It shouldn't be like that, you know. Publicly run utilities. It is an absolute shame that we have private utility companies in America. It is disgusting, and it's no coincidence that we pay the highest energy costs out there. It's no coincidence. Electricity bill, water bill, sewage bill. I mean, just fill in the blank. They gas bill, everything. You know, you should see the bills that come our way in my living situation right now. It's unbelievable. Like I said, they have to charge you for everything. You know, they have to, under capitalism, they have to charge you the most for everything, for the least amount of services out there. And so it's a shame. I mean, water, how in the world can somebody own water? How in the world can we have a privatized water system in America? I mean, look what happened in Flint, for crying out loud. And we allow this to take place. I mean, the nerve of these companies and people that would defend these companies. Oh, that's freedom. You know, I don't want to live in Cuba. Well, guess what? I guarantee you that the folks over at Cuba who just, you know, withstood this hurricane, they don't have water bills. And they don't have they don't spend as much money as we do on natural resources. It's disgusting. It really is. And don't get fooled by the gas prices here in America. I mean, the gas prices are actually much higher if you factor in all the tax subsidies we give to these companies and all the externalities. So, you know, these are key components in the election boycott advocates' approach. And they're very, very important. Now, the first part of our manifesto says the election boycott is the first step in a struggle for democracy, for alternative democratic government to replace the plutocratic imperialist police state and the liberation of working people so that ordinary Americans can manage their society and economy themselves in their own interests. The election boycott is the first step in noncompliance, folks. How many times have we said that here on this program? Once you start to wrap your head around that and say, you know what, not voting, I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to participate in a rigged game. I'm not going to participate in plutocratic elections. I'm going to urge people to join our movement to reject, you know, electoralism, reject the idea that somehow we're going to be able to reform the system. No, it's not going to happen. Why in the world would we think that that's going to happen? By electing these phony politicians, by having mass movements coalesce with politicians. No, we need to stay away from these people. And we need to delegitimize our elections. You know, it's like the media I was talking about in the first hour. I don't watch the media because, to me, the media is invalid. You know, the TV stations and the newspapers and this and that, they all are invalid. You know, they're funded by businesses that want to keep the status quo. The news is disseminated by, you know, individuals by and large that have no connection to the working class. They're told what to say. They're told what to print. The media is completely phony. You don't have dissenting point of views in the media. You don't have dissent. You have basically coercion. You know, you have the allowable, the acceptable opinion represented in the media, and qualified dissidents, you know, people like us, revolutionaries, we're not on the media airwaves. The media airwaves are not reserved for us. So this is my first step towards non-compliance. You know, I don't comply with the corporate media, and I don't comply with those that are on it. They're meaningless to me. They mean nothing to me, and I don't watch it. That's the power that I have. Instead, I go to alternative media sources, shows like this. That's where I get my information, because that's where I know I'm going to get the truth. I'm going to get, you know, the opinions that are out there. Because as I said, most Americans, there's a natural attraction between working class Americans and socialism. And you'd never know that in the corporate media. You would never know that there's been an uptick in support for socialism. You would never know that capitalism is a complete failure, because that's not allowed. That's not allowed. That is not allowed on the corporate media. So it's the same thing with our elections. You reject it, reject our elections, you know, reject anything associated with our elections, because they mean nothing. They're completely meaningless. We live in a plutocratic country, okay? Now, we also go on to say plurality of Americans have been boycotting federal elections for more than a half century, but only as individuals, silently letting their rulers know that they did not support them, but a passive protest. Now, with the advent of the election boycott advocates, the silent majority of voters has found the voice that will make what was implicit explicit, what was silent loud, what was unconscious thoughtful and public. That's a very, very important point, because we have to get people, we have to spread the revolutionary spirit out there and get people not to vote and express their dissatisfaction with the system. Because, again, Americans, by and large, don't vote. I mean, a very low percentage of eligible voters actually vote. Because when you boil it down, when you actually talk to these people, they don't have much to vote for. They realize that their interests are invalid, you know, mean nothing to the ruling class. You know, the ruling class may pretend to you know, listen. They may pretend, you know, that they give lip service all the time. The press has to give lip service all the time. But at the end of the day, it's only the business community that counts. It's only their interests that are represented, the very wealthy. And the poor and working poor are treated as commodities in this disgusting society. And we go on to point out that the reason why, as I said, so many millions of Americans, mostly working class, don't vote is because their vote doesn't count. The ruling elite have the real power, the overwhelming financial superiority to enact their agenda. Now, you know, I had Stuart Acuff on the program years ago, And Stuart Acuff is a Democratic guy. You know, he was an Obama advisor. He was with the SEIU for a while, okay? But he wrote a book with Dr. Richard Levins years ago. And one of the points he made was power. Power is how you get things done in society. And the ruling class, have all the power. Even though we have the masses. I mean, we have more and more people on our side. But it almost doesn't matter because they have a ways to divide us. You know, they have institutions that are dedicated to dividing us. They have the media out there. Well, you know, both sides of this issue and this and that. Oh, that's how they divide the working class. And that's how they exercise their power, ladies and gentlemen. 2008 financial collapse. You want to talk about power? When has Congress ever panicked the way that we saw them panic? I mean, when was the last time you saw the head of the Federal Reserve, who was it, Ben Bernanke? Or what's the other guy's name? Hank Paulson. Out on television, you know, explaining how things are and you know, directing the government on what to do. That's power. I mean, you know, that's Wall Street behind closed doors. You know, Larry Summers, that scumbag who was Obama's economic advisor from Goldman Sachs, one of these firms, just hedge fund guy, you know, has all these angry bankers in his office and they're telling him what to do. And, you know, they told the government what to do, not the other way around. That's power, ladies and gentlemen. That is how you get things done. Lobbying. I mean, Jesus, how many registered lobbyists do we have? It's just all power. And I hate that. Power is fundamentally undemocratic, I would argue. And that's why the very wealthy and the ruling elite, they know how to exercise power. They know how to use power. They're magnets towards power in any organization. Whereas somebody like myself, a worker, I don't care about power. I care about what's right. You know, I don't care about screwing other people over to get to the next level as so many people do in this rotten system, this rotten society that we have. I say what's on my mind. I don't try to manipulate people. I'm not a hustler. I've never been a hustler in my life, folks. I'm not. And the wealthy are hustlers. You know, I know people like this. And I usually don't like to make anecdotal arguments about, you know, stuff like this, but it's true. You know, they're all hustlers and they're you know, it's actually been proven about wealthy people is that they're more reserved and they're more manipulative and more thieving and whatnot. They're more likely to you know, steal and just like. That's not how I am. I tell it like it is. I tell it like I see it. I don't try to manipulate. I don't try to misrepresent myself. And if you don't like me, you don't like me. Then screw you. That's it. You know? And it's like workers are – it's like you can be almost too pure for this system. You know? And I think that's what we have here. And power is just, it's corrupt. Power breeds corruption. And that's what we have right here. So we've got a repudiation of the election system. We got a repudiation of elections in general, where 90% of the winners in congressional elections raise more money than their opponents. We have a system that's built on money. I mean, it's just rotten. It's rotten to the core. And this is why we need to refer back to the Election Boycott website and go over our manifesto and educate people, you know, That's a very, very important endeavor, probably one of the most important endeavors that we can engage in here on Carson's Corner or anywhere, you know. Because I got to tell you, you know, we have to see who's going to be around to pick up the pieces next when capitalism collapses again. You know, because we're very close to becoming fascism, a fascist society. Now, let me tell you what fascism is. We're not close to a fascist society right now. Let me rephrase that. Because fascism is defined as extreme nationalism coupled with dictatorial power where oppression or opposition is suppressed, and the state controls the commerce and production. Okay? That's basically a textbook definition of fascism. Extreme nationalism combined with authoritarianism, dictatorship, where opposition is thwarted, is eliminated, and the state controls commerce and the means of production and production property. It's what you had in Nazi Germany, you know? I mean, it's really, really that simple. We have private ownership over the means of production right now. We do have nationalism in America with Donald Trump, question about it, but and oppression or opposition has been suppressed. There's no question about it. I mean, there really is very, very little real opposition in the way of economic proceedings, you know. There's no unions. There's no consumer groups anymore. You know, they're withered away. There's no regulatory agencies anymore, nothing. But again, you know, they're not going to give up their power. They're not going to give up their wealth for you know, an authoritative regime. That's not going to happen. So we're not fascists. We're not becoming a fascist country. We can, though, in another economic collapse. We certainly can. And, you know, we need the workers to pick up the pieces. And it's not a good question of picking up the pieces and putting it back together again. It's about picking up the pieces and building a whole new system. Because, as I said before, you cannot reform the system. Anything is short from, you know, total revolution, political revolution, is a failure. Is not going to emancipate the working class. It's just not going to happen. And so, you know, being that we can delegitimize the system, cause people to boycott and urge people to continue to boycott. And I'm hoping that we can eventually delegitimize the system and then start from scratch. But, you know, sometimes it doesn't always work out like that. And sometimes events can trigger other events. So who knows how it's going to happen. But I know that there's going to be a political revolution. There has to be. It's the only way we're going to survive, really, because I just don't think the working class can continue on its current trajectory. And that's why we need socialist revolution. We need an economic system in which the wealth that is produced is distributed collectively. And that's not going to happen under capitalism. Under capitalism, we're not getting any of the wealth that we're producing. None. Nada. I have nothing. I have no wealth. I have nothing to my name. African Americans, by and large, have very little wealth. Nothing in terms of wealth. The working class can't even get together $1,000. under capitalism. Home ownership is down, you know, decade lows. Debt has replaced paychecks under capitalism. The cost of living continues to go up relative to our paychecks. Everything continues to go up, but our paychecks. And that has stayed the same. And that has been the case since Ronald Reagan. I mean, again, we're being screwed. Every single day you go to work, every day that goes by, the working class is being screwed. You know, if it were up to me, and if we're up to the election boycott advocates, we would sign a decree right now mandating the forfeiture of all wealth in under capitalism. All wealth that has been created has been created at the expense of workers. And we talked about this last week. You know, we're not coming back for a few pennies. You know, you got Dr. Robert Reich talking about dynastic wealth. And yeah, that's right. Dynastic wealth is it's killing us. Accumulation is destroying the working class on so many different ways. However, we're not going to come for pennies. We want all of our wealth that we've created. It is immoral. It is unfeasible to have, you know, the Walton family own more wealth than 42% of Americans. These people did nothing but were born into a family started by Sam Walton. It's immoral to have billionaires in America. It's wrong. And, you know, so we need an alternative economic system, and we need socialism, because this system is not working for anybody but the ruling class. And that is an absolute fact, ladies and gentlemen. 347-326-9749 if you want to call and be a part of the program. We only got about 15 minutes left or so. And let's see here. You know, we've got a little Facebook debate here. I don't want to really get involved with this because one of my guys from my MMA show is making a lot of comments about African Americans, racist comments, or, you know, I prejudice comments, whatever. I don't even want to repeat them, and I don't want to get involved with this. I probably should facilitate it, but I don't know. So that's why we need socialist revolution. That is why we need an alternative economic system. And I just find it absolutely ridiculous that in this day and age, there's not even a discussion as to whether or not we're going to have a competing economic system. We're not even allowed to have the discussion if you comply with the corporate media and you comply with the elections. Third parties may start to pop up, I think, but really they're going to be meaningless too, because of the different laws and because of the different rules that the two parties have in place. It's just, you know, again, any party within the current system, any effort within the current system is doomed to failure. It really is. So I don't, you know, we may start to see this, because you got to remember, Congress's approval rating continues to be extremely low and will be low. Okay. And despite this, you know, most incumbents get reelected, which I find absolutely amazing. But that's the truth. You know, how would that just shows you, if you need any more evidence about a rigged game, then I don't know what else to tell you. That is one of the many, many pieces of evidence about how we lived in a we live in a rigged system here. It's just you know, we've had third party candidates before. We had Ross Perot running in, was it 92? It got something like 18% of the vote, running against NAFTA. You had Ralph Nader, Jill Stein, but they're all just jokes. I mean, they're all, again, they have no shot. Nobody knows who they are, and it's a waste of time. It really is. And Christopher Allen Driscoll said last week that, you know, Nader was somebody that wanted to work. He was a third-party candidate that wanted to work with whoever he could. Well, guess what? Workers cannot work with, you know, businessmen. Not under the current structure right now. We need a worker takeover of the means of production. We need to establish worker-owned cooperatives that control commercial enterprises, productive property. We need public banks, public utilities, a public health system. That's what we need. And you can't compromise on those principles. You can't, you know, you can't work with your oppressor. You know, it's just not going to help you. It's going to hurt you. And so that is why, again, we need socialism, ladies and gentlemen. It works in every other country that has it. I mean, arguably, there's no pure socialist country out there. But there are many countries that practice economic policies designed to, you know, reduce income inequality, reduce inequality, whatnot, you know? So I think we could look at the best parts of different countries, and we could, you know, create a model for what we have, what we should have here in the United States. You know, as I said, we have many countries in the world that are definitely more socialist than we are. You know, you've got China. We've spoken about China in this country, on this show. Actually, under China, many companies are run by the government. Okay? China is government. Is economic system, their economy is a socialist economy, okay? Their workers have received more minimum wage increases than our workers have. Their economy has grown a lot more than our economy has over the last, you know, 30 plus years. In fact, I'm not even sure. They may even overtake us in terms of the largest GDP. Denmark. Another company, another country, wide range of welfare benefits, and they have the highest tax rates in the world. And that's a very, very important point, too, is the tax rate that the business community pays, because if you have a high tax rate on businesses, you discourage speculation, you encourage business growth, and you reduce income inequality. I mean, the history of taxation shows that, ladies and gentlemen. When businesses don't pay taxes and we allow the business community to write the tax code, guess what? You have what we have right now. You have a tax code with, you know, holes so big that a 747 jet can drive through it. That's what we have right now. That is a key component in the stabilization of our economy, is high taxes, because high taxes on the very wealthy. Again, the very wealthy, the rich have to pay a lion's share of all types of taxes out there. And if they do, you know, if you start taxing wealth at 70-80% or income at 70-80% after a certain point, then what will happen is instead of the top 1% of scumbags earning, you know, 25 or 30% of the income or 40%, whatever it is now, it's going up and up and up, and all of the wealth, that number goes down. You'll have 1% of income earners. Instead, they'll control 9% of the income or whatever it is. The lower that number goes down, the better it is for society, because society, workers, who, as I said, not had a pay increase in 30-plus years, their paychecks will go up and they'll be able to buy more things. And we won't have any of the problems that we're having right now. We just have to marginalize the rich. Taxation is a very, very important tool. And the rate of taxation tells you all you need to know about society. Because if you have a tax rate as low as we do here, where the rich don't pay taxes, okay, and the corporations don't pay taxes, then guess what? You have income inequality, and the tax burden gets shifted to people like us. Last year, I paid 25% in taxes, and I didn't make a lot of money, folks, okay? That's a disgrace, and I have no say over that tax rate, because the taxes are taken out of my check before I get it. Finland, another example of socialism. Now, I realize that the definition of socialism differs. I mean, I've had debates with comrades about this. But, you know, for all practical purposes, we're talking about social programs. We're talking about welfare benefits. We're talking about, you know, more government involvement in our economy. Finland has one of the best education systems, no tuition, free meals to all students. And guess what? The literacy rate in Finland is 100%. They have one of the highest living standards of the world. Yeah, that is a very nice country. Now, could you imagine if we had no tuition fees? Could you imagine if the students, and I put myself in this category because I have an insurmountable amount of student loan debt. Could you imagine if the students didn't have to pay student loan debt? Could you imagine if the students, many of whom are not privileged enough to come from a wealthy family, can get a mortgage or start a business when they graduate college instead of having to pay back these ridiculous student loan bills, where the banks lend the money out and the banks know that you're not going to be able to get a job, so they charge you all, you know, high interest rates, and you can't pay them back? I'm not going to be able to pay my student loan. As far as I'm concerned, the student loan debt should be considered invalid, because there was a time in America where we had, you know, nonprofit universities, and it was much, much better, and you didn't have the problems. Again, we're saddling our students with debt to maintain this inefficient, wasteful private education system that's a racket. And other countries are leading the way. Other countries are waiving tuition fees and achieving better results than we are here in the United States. And it's a disgrace. It really is. We're giving all this money to the banksters, and kids are graduating college with a meaningless 4-year degree because education is rendered useless in capitalism. Skills and education are rendered useless in capitalism. And so this is a really, really big point. And the Republican Party doesn't care about education because they realize that most college-educated students are not going to vote for them. So what do they care? They're, you know, appealing to the 30-35% of people I was talking about earlier. You know, This is a very, very important point. It's a very egalitarian and organized society there in Finland, and we should desire to become more like Finland. Canada, our neighbors to the north, another socialist-like country that has a extensive welfare system and free health care and medical care. That is a very, very important point, ladies and gentlemen, health care, medical care, because that's another albatross around the neck of the working class under capitalism. We're just drowning in a sea of student loan debt and medical debt, and who's making money? Who's thriving? It's the corporations. It's the business community. It's not us. The working class are dying. We are literally dying under capitalism with this rotten healthcare system that we have that's so wasteful and inefficient that the number one cause of bankruptcy as of a few years ago was healthcare bills. And I'm in debt too for healthcare bills. It's unbelievable. I qualified for Medicaid. I should be getting Medicaid soon, which is really, really good healthcare. Medicaid is amazing. And we'll see. You know, the only reason why I qualified for it, because I don't have an income. I haven't worked. You know, that's it. So we're spending 15-16% of our GDP on healthcare. That continues to go up. The average American is spending 10% of their yearly income on healthcare. Premiums continue to rise. Healthcare companies continue to get fatter and fatter at all of our expense. And why do we keep this system? I don't understand. What's stopping us? What's stopping us from having a national health service? It's power. It's what I was talking about earlier. The insurance companies have the power to maintain the system. They own the politicians. They own the government. They own the friggin' elections. They have everything. We got to put them out of business. And that'll come with the socialist revolution, because the idea of a for-profit insurance company is ruled out by default. The idea of for-profit utility companies are ruled out by default. Banks, for-profit banks, ruled out by default. This doesn't exist in our society. Well, Bob, that's going to kill innovation. What are you doing? You're going to kill people's entrepreneurial spirit and their creativeness. No, quite the opposite. You get the health insurance companies off my back. You get the banksters off my back with their tuition. I have a lot more time to create. I have a lot more time to be innovative. I have a lot more time to exist, not rent myself out to the highest bidder under capitalism, which is nothing, which is a mere fraction of what I'm worth. And so it's the exact opposite, because we're renting ourselves out for survival under capitalism. That's what we're doing. That's what a majority of working class people are doing right now. I mean, I'm looking for jobs every day, and it's pathetic. It's absolutely pathetic. Job paying $10 an hour, are hard to come by under this fake, system where, again, your education is rendered useless. Your skills are rendered useless. Your experience is rendered useless by and large. And don't believe me. Take a look around you. Go outside and look at your mailman. Look at your 7-Eleven clerk. Look at your, construction guy. Is that where they wanted to be when they started out life? No. But again, this rotten system deprives people of opportunity. We're killing ourselves, ladies and gentlemen. We're allowing them to kill us. And I say enough is enough. Okay, pal. Okay, Tony. All right. We're just about out of time here on Carson's Corner. I want to thank anybody out there who's listening. We have a very, very good show. I'm sure next week We're going to have Christopher Alan Driscoll back with us. And I'm also trying to see if I can get Cindy Sheehan. That should be really, really fun. Cindy Sheehan, of course, the mother of Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Iraq in, I forget what year, maybe 2004. I don't want to give off a bit of misinformation like our friend Tom Hartman did. But we'd like to have her on the program, and she's agreed, and so we should have her sometime soon in the near future. What do we have now here? Yeah, so I got to all of our topics, all my topics I want to discuss today. The NFL anthem controversy crap, who cares? You know, I don't care what LeBron James has to say about the president. I don't care. I want to see these football players move towards socialism as opposed to just being reactionary. I think it's a double standard that, you know, some people can't tolerate this type of dissent. I know people in my own personal life that are so intolerant that I can't even be around them. We also spoke about the election boycott advocates and our manifesto. You can go to our website at electionboycott.weebly.com. That is electionboycott.weebly.com and check us out there. Also, you could join the Facebook group. Just type in election boycott advocates on Facebook and make sure to participate in the discussion in that group. Lastly, I want you to follow us here on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. That is blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. Every Monday night, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio. It is Carson's Corner with the election boycott advocates, with yours truly and, of course, Christopher Alan Driscoll. And that's about it, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to friend me personally on Facebook, please do so. Facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Also, Twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. I do have another podcast where I cover the sport of mixed martial arts. That's a very, very good show. And it's also a revolutionary show. Everything we do here on Carson's Corner is revolutionary. So, all right, thanks a lot. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.